All right, folks, today we're coming back to what many might call Conspiracy 101, examining the history of the Rockefeller family, the other early American industrialists, and how they've shaped the world since the late 1800s, because many people doubt that on a crowded planet, so much influence and power could really be attained by just a handful of families. But when you know the history, you don't really have to guess. And it becomes clear that the oily appendages of the nefarious few weave through every major sector of life, including energy, transportation, education, food, media, money, medicine, and more. And if this isn't full spectrum dominance, you tell me what's left. I mean, I'd say not much, but here to help us pick up the pieces of the puzzle few dare to put together is one of my favorite journalists and content creators working today, James Corbett. If you're unfamiliar, James is the one-man band behind CorbettReport.com, where he writes, records, and produces thousands of hours of video, podcasts, articles, and more. He's one of the best, and he really puts my work ethic to shame. Ladies and gentlemen, the gold standard, James Corbett, welcome to the Higher Side.
Well, thanks for having me back on, but don't put yourself down. Don't sell yourself short there. Oily appendages of a nefarious few, that right there takes the cake. I don't think I can top that this whole interview.
Well, thanks, man. Thanks. And it is a real pleasure. We have done this once before, way back in 2013. I'm really psyched to do it again. The main thing that prompted me to get in touch with you again was this documentary you made a few months back, about 70 minutes long, called How Big Oil Conquered the World. And at first I thought, I don't really need to see this. I know this story. But the truth is, that part of history has been so concealed that with each retelling, I think you're going to learn a lot of new stuff. And it's so well made that it's got to be my new go-to recommendation for anyone who needs to be conspiratorially educated. It's that good, man.
Well, thank you very much. I do appreciate that. And it's great to hear that, because truly this is an encapsulation of a lot of the research that I've been doing for almost, well, about a decade now. So I tried as best I could to try to compress that into an hour or 70 minutes. I hope it speaks for itself.
Yeah, it definitely does. It's so well condensed down, and it's very down to earth and practical and easy to grasp. And I guess to get us started here, most people, they know a little bit about John D. Rockefeller and Standard Oil, but how did the saga get started? What do you consider the beginning of the big oil story?
Well, in the documentary and just generally, I do tend to go back to the progenitor of the Rockefeller clan, not John D. Rockefeller, but his father, because it's an interesting little topic that not a lot of people know about, but it is a perfectly, completely 100% admitted part of the story. It's not conspiracy theory or anything. It's just part of the Rockefeller story that John D. Rockefeller's father was William Rockefeller, who changed his name to William Livingston because of a string of, well, I mean, he was a rogue. He was a cad. He was not only a philanderer and someone who went town to town literally selling snake oil, but he was also a rapist and a bigamist. And he was run out of town and eventually left the family more or less and adopted the name Livingston and died elsewhere apart from the family. So that is the real origins of the Rockefeller clan. And I think it's, I mean, doubly or triply or quadruply ironic that the originator of the Rockefeller dynasty was literally a snake oil salesman. And I think the apple didn't fall far from the tree, although the official story of the Rockefeller dynasty is that John D. learnt from his father, in a sense, learned what not to do. He grew up under the tutelage of his very devout Baptist mother and became a very devout Baptist man and understood, you know, the work ethic that would bring him and his family out of kind of not the grinding poverty they were in, but they weren't in a great situation. And he realized he had to, you know, pull himself up by his bootstraps and all of that. That's the way they try to take that story. But the other version of that story is another oft-told tale that William Rockefeller used to brag that he tried to cheat his boys every chance he got because he wanted to make them sharp. And again, I think, I mean, that's a pretty interesting upbringing for someone who eventually went on to become really one of the world's most richest and influential people.
Right. Yeah, those are crucial details in learning about how this family and how this saga kind of unfolded. And one of my favorite parts of it is the prohibition subtext. And I was aware of that kind of hidden history there, and I do want to elaborate on it in a little bit. But as far as dominating the energy space and suppressing other options early on, prohibition, I've learned from this documentary, is really just the tip of the iceberg, because as they built their empire and started had things to compete with, you say that in the film, in the earliest forms of electric vehicles, they go back as far as the 1830s, and the first electric car was made in 1884. I mean, this is probably really surprising for a lot of people who've been led to believe that the technology just isn't there and that oil is the only option. I mean, what else can you say about the electric car component in the late 1800s that people probably aren't aware of?
Well, I think, I mean, you brought up the salient points there, that a technology for electric engines went back to the early part of the 19th century, and that commercially available electric cars were there by the 1880s. And in fact, I mean, it wasn't just some sort of pipe dream type of thing. It was an actually operable technology. In London, there was a fleet of all electric taxis that were taking passengers around London by 1897. And at the turn of the 20th century, the world land speed record was set by an electric car. And in fact, 28% of the cars in the U.S. in the 20th century, at the dawn of the 20th century, and around the turn of 1900, were electric. So it wasn't a small part of the market by any means, and it wasn't at all certain at that point that the gasoline-powered engine was going to be the dominant form of the engine that would take hold and become the basis for society, which was a potential problem for the would-be monopolists of the burgeoning oil industry, which had really taken off on the basis of the fact that whale oil, whale blubber, which was still being used primarily for lamps and heating in homes, was becoming very scarce. Whales were being hunted to extinction in a lot of cases. So it was becoming something that was difficult to replace. And suddenly we had this new techniques for refining petroleum into kerosene for lamp oil. And that was really the basis for the takeoff of the industry in the 1860s. But by the turn of the 20th century, electricity, electric lights were really taking over that share of the market. So they really did need a new catalyst, a new reason for gasoline and petroleum-derived products to be the basis for society in order to maintain the market shares that they had. And the engine and automobile was the perfect thing to come along at the perfect time in order for them to do that. But, of course, it did have competition, as you say, like the electric engine, which at the time, in the turn of the 20th century, was a true competitor to the gasoline engines. It was not the dominant share of the market, but it was a large share. And that, of course, only dwindled after the striking of Spindletop in around 1900 in Texas, which brought unimaginable amounts of gasoline to the market relatively cheaply. And by that point, it started to become quite obvious that that electricity was not going to be the main operator for engine technology in the United States.
Right. And how synchronistic. I mean, it's like if they didn't find this huge reserve at the right time, they couldn't have lowered the price of oil down enough to where people basically considered it super cheap, and they might have priced other things out of the market. And it all does hinge on just a couple of key moments where they found these huge reservoirs. Because if it had taken maybe another 5 or 10 years, that market share might have grown to a degree that they really couldn't put the lid back on.
That's true. And it wasn't only electric engines. Of course, there was also alcohol engines. Fuel alcohol was a significant competitor, with alcohol engines technology being refined to the point that by 1909, the USGS actually published a report showing that there was a fuel economy equivalence between alcohol engines and gas engines, that there was you would get the same bang for the buck, as it were, between the two technologies. And again, it was Spindletop and the lowering of gasoline prices that really definitively turned the tide in favor of gasoline over alcohol fuel. So again, there's that other side of it. And then, of course, that brings in the prohibition movement that you were talking about earlier.
Right. And not only was alcohol an alternative, but it was actually seemed like in some ways a better fuel than gasoline. I mean, apparently it didn't burn as hot. It isn't as toxic, of course. And also people have better control over it. A farmer could have a still on his farm and harvest his own alcohol to, you know, fuel his tractors, fuel vehicles. And that component also makes it a better system. It is quite a shame that they were able to do this. But another aspect that is really interesting about this is the public transportation aspect. And man, this really pissed me off and surprised me because so many big cities in the United States don't have good transportation today. San Diego's is all right, but it's still mainly based on gas-guzzling buses. And now I kind of know why after watching your documentary. But tell us a little bit about what you call the Bustitution campaign and the National City Line saga. That's a pretty interesting piece of the puzzle.
It really is. And the funny part about this is that when you go and look this up online, it's trendy in recent years for people to come back with quote unquote so-called debunkings of this story, basically trying to say, oh, it's overblown. This isn't really how it happened, despite the fact that there was actually a federal indictment and successful prosecution of the companies that were involved in this. So officially on the court record, yes, they were guilty of it, but apparently it's this conspiracy theory to talk about it. But yes, this goes back to the point that after World War I, there was still very little actual private car ownership in the United States. Only 1 in 10 Americans actually even owned a car at that point. And the vast majority of certainly city dwellers relied on public transportation like electric trolley networks to get them around the towns. And there were extensive electric trolley networks in numerous cities across the United States. So what is an oil oligarch connected monopolist to do in a situation like that? Well, you had General Motors starting a front company called National City Lines, and members of that front company included Firestone Tire and Standard Oil of California. Standard Oil of California, obviously one of the offshoots of the Standard Oil Rockefeller dynasty that got broken up in 1910. And they started, as you say, a plan that they called Bustitution, or that was termed Bustitution, to scrap streetcars across the country, to tear up the railway lines and to replace it with basically with regular roads running GM buses on Standard Oil diesel fuel, of course. So they set to work specifically on that plan, and within a decade, they had already accomplished an incredible amount. They had scrapped over 100 municipal electric transit systems in 45 cities and put gas-burning GM buses on the streets in their place. And by 1955, nearly 90% of the electric streetcar lines in the United States had been ripped out or otherwise eliminated. That comes from F. William Engdahl in his book, Myths, Lies, and Oil Wars. And the more you look into it, the more fascinating it is. But the interesting part was that a lot of this was exposed by a retired naval lieutenant commander called Edwin J. Quimby, who was apparently quite a character in and of himself. But he wrote this manifesto talking about this Bustitution system and saying that this was a careful, deliberately planned campaign to swindle you out of your most important and valuable public utilities, your electric railway system. And he went on to detail how this National City Lines had been involved in destroying the public transportation lines in Baltimore, L.A., St. Louis, and other cities. And it was on the basis of his manifesto exposing this that it eventually started to get some media attention. And then in 1949, GM, Firestone, Standard Oil, their officers, their corporate associates were indicted. And they ultimately ended up paying a punishing fine of $5,000 for destroying, for example, I mean, if nothing else, LA's $100 million Pacific Electric system was scrapped as a result of this Pacific City Line plan, and they ended up paying a $5,000 fine for that. In fact, the director of Pacific City Lines was fined $1 for his participation in the scheme. Basically, the judge was saying, yes, you're guilty of this, but I don't think it was a big problem. I think this is overblown. So, it ultimately ends up obviously very well for people who wanted to transform the United States into what we now think of as American car culture. I mean, America is built around the car. Well, it wasn't built around the car by accident. It was part of a very strategic plan that was drawn up in the boardrooms of oligarch-connected companies and was put into place. It was put into operation. And not only were they not significantly fined or imprisoned or damaged in any way for this, you ended up having the I mean, just the hideous situation that in 1953, President Eisenhower appointed Charles Wilson, the president of GM, as his Secretary of Defense. And what did this president of General Motors do as Secretary of Defense of the United States? He, of course, started the federal highways system. He started to put in the interstate highways, which ultimately ended up not only, I mean, obviously the Pacific City Lines, National City Lines had already taken out the transportation systems within cities, but between cities, rail was still the most popular form of travel until they started the interstate highway system, directed by literally the president of General Motors. And that ultimately led to an 84% decline in rail travel in the two decades between 1945 and 1964.
God, man, it's just, it's an amazing saga, and our view is so skewed. We think we just don't have these public transportation systems because, you know, the investment's never been made, or I've at some points thought, oh, well, maybe these cities just kind of grew too fast and they're way too kind of dense now to institute such a thing. But when you find out that it was all there already, and of course, if these things had been protected, they would have been updated over time. It is just so sad, man. And I think about all these alternatives, what the country could have been like today if they were allowed to have stayed where they were. I mean, what if electric cars had just been the normal and cities weren't covered in smoke and people weren't breathing in all that Rockefeller bullshit? Also, oil is such a big part of our geopolitics. We wouldn't need to get involved in all of that stuff. And now they have maglev technology. I mean, obviously we're being denied that, and who really knows what else? People really need to get pissed about this, wouldn't you say?
Well, let's put it this way. I'm a Canadian who now lives in Japan. I've been living here for 12 years, and the rail system here is just such an integral part of Japanese culture, and it's something that's really, I mean, I genuinely enjoy taking my little rail journeys here. I genuinely enjoy going on the high-speed bullet train here because it is, it's such a convenient and such a just a good way to travel. I mean, it makes so much sense that it boggles my mind that in Canada, where I'm from, or in the United States, or anywhere else that you can think of in a lot of developed countries, there isn't such a system. And obviously, it's not like there are no problems with that kind of system. It was developed, for example, in Japan, as with most countries where that type of system takes off. It was developed primarily because of government monopoly, which was then broken up and privatized, and is only serving to enrich a very few who happen to be politically connected. But the idea of it and the fact that it does make money and it can make money, that's part of the lie that they want to sell you about this, is that, oh, it's just, it doesn't make any economic sense to do this. Well, no, it does. And it can work. And not in all markets, not in all ways, but it certainly can work. And as you say, the infrastructure was already there in dozens of cities across the United States. It would have just needed updating, upgrading. It wouldn't have needed, you know, a complete overhaul. And that's really the significant expense of it. So it was already there to be used. And it took time and effort and money and lobbying to get it taken out, specifically for the benefit of these companies.
Right. And it also puts a twist on certain things like, you know, sometimes when people talk about what the federal government should be doing with our money, they'll cite something like a program like the highway system, the institution of it, or the electrical grid. And yeah, these are moments where we really did have the manpower and the will to set something up for the entire countrywide community that would be beneficial or technologically advantageous. But really, when you learn about why it happened, it's really just publicly funding the wealth extraction grids for a few wealthy industrialists. That's the only true motivation for why those things happened.
Yes. And speaking as an anarchist, I would say that's what government is. I mean, that's all it ever is. That's why it always devolves to that point. That's why it's always to the benefit of the politically connected few, because it is a government enforced monopoly on violence, ultimately, which is what underlies the system. But of course, underneath that threat of violence, they can do all sorts of things to extract wealth from some people and give it to others. And it always devolves into basically a looting of the hordes of people. And that's exactly what we can see with the development of these companies, these corporations, which in every way, in every turn that they took, was always benefited by various government rulings and government orders and government regulations that regulated their competition out of existence and allowed them to operate and allowed them to do things like creating the National City Lines to get rid of the public transportation systems. And all of this was enabled, of course, by that that government monopoly on power and violence. And so that's why I think, I mean, the idea that we could somehow have some, you know, benevolent caretaker government, I'll believe it when I see it. I've never seen it in existence, and I don't think we ever will.
Yeah, I mean, I like to be an optimist and maybe think it's possible, but you can't argue that we haven't seen it yet, that's for sure. And like you mentioned, the nerfed consequences of the conviction, you know, a $5,000 fine and a $1 fine for H.C. Grossman for destroying all the public transportation. That is another interesting aspect of the documentary, is the history you lay out in the film. You can almost see the race to control the media and the government before the media and the people really wise up and realize what's happening. You know, some journalists and politicians were concerned, but the tide just swallowed them up, it seems. And maybe you can elaborate on how it got to be that way. How did we go from really kind of despising these billionaire industrialists to worshiping them?
Yes, unfortunately, again, this is not just some sort of accident of history. This is a very coordinated plan that was put into place and accomplished on the back of the nearly infinite, for all intents and purposes, resource of the Rockefellers and their ilk. And I mean, it's fascinating. This probably deserves, well, actually, almost every single aspect of this documentary deserves a documentary unto itself. But this one in particular interests me because obviously I'm in alternative media. This is what I do. And the history of media as we know it and what we understand as the media is so integrally tied into this story and these monopolists of the 19th century, turning the tide of public opinion, as you say, from being despised by the average sort of working stiff in the U.S. or where have you, to the point where we're at today, where you have these memes that go around online about good guy Gates. You know, Bill Gates is one of the most wonderful beatific human beings on the planet. And it's so ridiculous that you have to wonder, well, is there something behind this? And there is. One example of that would be Ida Tarbell, who was a kind of muckraking journalist around the turn of the 20th century, who wrote an explosive series of reports about Rockefeller, John D. Rockefeller, and the Standard Oil monopoly and how it came into existence, the types of practices it used to get its power and what it did, you know, to keep its power. Mm-hmm. And it was a very popular series of reports that really did galvanize public opinion against Rockefeller. And just go and look at some of the sort of editorial cartoons and depictions of Rockefeller from that time period, and none of them are flattering. They're all about, you know, Rockefeller's head and his arms are these octopus legs encircling the globe, or, you know, those types of things where it's always this insidious, horrible influence that really encompasses, in some cases, literally he has the Congress in his hand and he's kind of inspecting them, you know, to see what he can get out of them. And those types of depictions were very common. That was truly by far and away the sense of the American public around the turn of the 20th century as to what it meant for a Rockefeller or people like him to have that much money and power and influence. People understood that to be something anathema to the idea of some sort of, you know, government by and for the people, or whatever people want to believe about what the American government is supposed to be for. So that was what Ida Tarbell and the muckraking press were capable of at that time. And obviously, I mean, Rockefeller and the Standard Oil dynasty and the people around him knew this was a problem. I mean, public opinion can count for a very long way. And if you have the public on your side, you can get away with a lot more. So essentially, I mean, you can essentially say the Rockefeller family created the modern PR industry. They hired Ivy Ledbetter Lee, who is credited, and I mean, you can go and look at any mainstream textbook, as one of the founders of modern PR. They hired Ivy Ledbetter Lee, who was just a journalist and turned a communications expert, to basically invent the PR industry to resuscitate the Rockefellers' image. And he started to construct a series of, I mean, he did all sorts of just basic tricks that went a very long way towards changing the public opinion of John D. Rockefeller in particular, and then ultimately to all of his business interests. Like these days, a lot of people, if you ask your grandparents or maybe your great-grandparents, they would probably associate John D. Rockefeller with dimes because he was always photographed. From a certain point, they just told him, oh, whenever you're photographed or we'll set up these kind of, you know, on-camera appearances, you should, you know, give out dimes to children. And that became the thing, the image that would be plastered all over the newspapers because, oh, here's John D. Rockefeller handing out dimes to little children and telling them to invest it wisely and whatever. And this became like the image of Rockefeller. It's just such a basic PR trick that if we saw this today, I'd like to think we would be wise to that game, but perhaps the game is not all that much more advanced these days. But anyway, those types of just basic PR tricks were literally invented by Ivy Lee specifically to resuscitate John D. Rockefeller's image, and it went a remarkable way towards doing so. I mean, as I say, at the turn of the 20th century, no one probably was more despised, more universally despised than John D. Rockefeller, and within a decade or two, he was known. He was synonymous for being the great philanthropist, giving away all his money to all of these great charities. And of course, when you're giving away money, unspeakable, unimaginable, you know, gobs of money that people could barely even comprehend, you're going to get a lot of great press from a lot of people who benefit from that in very obvious ways. But a lot of people are less interested in really scrutinizing that philanthropy and looking at what is it actually accomplishing and finding out that in case after case after case after case, all of this wonderful philanthropy that John D. Rockefeller was doing was directly benefiting himself and his business interests.
Right. It is so amazing. And people really got to see it, the Rockefeller PR machine in motion, because you show a lot of the real footage in this documentary, and it is so transparent now that we've kind of grown up with this stuff and the tools have been so much better refined. When you look at the early version of it, it's kind of easy to see through, but it's really something you got to experience, because when you see it, you just know this doesn't seem genuine. It seems clunky.
Yeah, they just happen to have the film cameras rolling as he's going around, you know, handing out dimes to these people.
Right. Yeah. And you know, the guy could tell 5,000 kids who walk up to him poor and hungry to fuck off, and no one would ever know, as long as you get the one time he gives a dime to someone on camera. That's the only thing people hear about spread throughout the land on the new airwaves.
That's it. People understand what they see and hear. Again, it does seem so basic to us, but for people who were confronting this as a brand new medium and a new way of interacting with the public, it was, well, it was quite a revelation, and something that unfortunately, again, got taken up and used to great effect by the darkest powers in society in many ways.
Yeah, I just love that angle. And we also had mentioned that alcohol was an alternative to oil at that time and that it was the true motivation behind prohibition. But maybe you can elaborate on that a little bit for people who might be kind of new to the idea, because when you first hear it, it's kind of shocking. But that's the underlying truth, isn't it?
Yes. Yes, it is. And again, for people who don't know the history of it, ethyl alcohol, ethanol, had been used since the early 19th century, both in engines and as fuel for lamps. And it was more expensive than petroleum-derived products, but it was more accessible in places like London or Paris or places like that that at that time did not have some steady access to oil supplies. So it was quite popular, and the earliest gasoline engines were almost universally designed to run on either alcohol or gasoline. For example, Henry Ford famously designed the Model T to run on either alcohol or gasoline. So it was not baked into the cake at that point, at the turn of the 20th century, that gasoline would be the de facto and standard and only real choice for fuel for these engines. And Henry Ford was, in fact, quite a champion for the idea of ethyl alcohol. He said to the New York Times, and this was in the 1920s, after the, you know, it had really been decided pretty much definitively in favor of petroleum. He said to the New York Times, the fuel of the future is going to come from fruit like that sumac out by the road, or from apples, weed, sawdust, almost anything. There is fuel in every bit of vegetable matter that can be fermented. The idea here is that ethyl alcohol would be the perfect antidote to a completely monopolizable resource like petroleum. Petroleum obviously can be controlled from wellhead to gas pump and everything in between, exactly as Standard Oil did. That vertical monopoly can be very definitively controlled, whereas something that can literally be processed out of anything by anyone at home with a still, you know, I mean, it's just the exact opposite idea. And I think that's quite obviously why it could not be allowed to thrive by the oligarchs and their, you know, their fellow cohorts. So there was a tax on alcohol that had been instituted in the Civil War to help pay for the Civil War that, unsurprisingly, 50 years later was still in place. There was a big move to get this repealed, and even President Roosevelt in 1906 told the U.S. Congress that, and this is a direct quote, "The Standard Oil Company has largely by unfair or unlawful methods crushed out home competition. It is highly desirable that an element of competition should be introduced by the passage of some such law as which has already passed the House, putting alcohol used in the arts and manufactures upon the free list." So the idea here is that alcohol for fuel specifically should have this tax repealed. So in 1906, the tax was repealed, and corn ethanol was available at 14 cents a gallon, which was cheaper than gasoline at 22 cents a gallon. So at that moment in history, it was actually cheaper to use alcohol fuel, and it had the extra bonus, as I said, of being not monopolizable. That didn't last long. As I say, Spindletop changed that economy, and unfortunately, it definitively made it cheaper for gasoline. And the interesting part of all of this, as we talked about before, is that what really helped to turn the tide and ultimately crush the idea that alcohol fuel was going to ever replace gasoline was the prohibition movement. And it's kind of a tangential way in which this happened, but at any rate, the anti-alcohol, anti-drinking movement had been around in the United States for over 50 years by that point. You had had a number of movements arise because America was a particularly hard-drinking country at that time. The average American over 15 years old drank 7 gallons of pure alcohol per year, which is actually 3 times higher than today's average. So it was, I mean, it was a country of hard drinkers and people who like to work hard and play hard, I guess. This caused a lot of social problems. And so you had anti-alcohol movements starting in the 1830s and really gaining some steam in 1869 with the foundation of the Prohibition Party. And then you had the Women's Christian Temperance Union in the 1870s. These were grassroots campaigns that were against the social ills of drinking alcohol. So that is where it came from. And it had some limited successes in quotation marks. I mean, for example, Maine outlawed the sale and manufacture of liquor in 1851, but only for 5 years. So there was a little bit of political movement, but not a lot of political movement until the 1890s. In fact, specifically in 1893, the Anti-Saloon League was formed in Ohio. And Ohio should ring a bell for people who know anything about the history of oil, because that's the birth home state of Standard Oil. And not surprisingly, the ACL founder and director was Howard Hyde Russell, who was a personal friend of John D. Rockefeller. And the ASL, the Anti-Saloon League, got generous annual donations from Rockefeller himself. And so this is when the political movement to force prohibition really started to take off. And by the turn of the 20th century, you started to see a genuine sort of popular political movement arising out of this. And the Anti-Saloon League was instrumental in that. Now, again, the official Rockefeller history will tell you it's because Rockefeller was a teetotaler himself. He just wanted, you know, he didn't like the effects of alcohol. He thought they were detrimental to community standards. He was such a pious, good Christian gentleman that he didn't want to see people debasing themselves. That's, again, the official story. Immediately and completely counteracted by his association with, for example, Stephen Harkness, who was one of the original investors in Standard Oil. He was a director in the company all the way until his death. And how did he catch Rockefeller's eye? He made gobs of money. He made a fortune by getting tips about an excise tax that was going to be introduced on whiskey. And he bought up all the whiskey in advance of the new tax so that he could then sell it at a huge profit after the tax kicked in. And he made I mean, that's how he made his fortune, and that's how he became, you know, one of the founding investors in Standard Oil. So clearly Rockefeller didn't have much of a ethical concern with the people who made their money from selling alcohol. But anyway, that being whatever it is, the point is Rockefeller did generously donate to the Anti-Saloon League, which was one of the key groups that helped to get the amendment into existence to enforce prohibition. And one of the immediate effects of prohibition, again, it's tangential, but it's important. One of the effects is, well, we can't have alcohol that could even potentially be used as a drinking for drinking. And, well, ethyl alcohol, it's dangerous, but people can drink it. So what we have to do is make sure that they don't drink it by deliberately poisoning it. So the government enforced a rule saying that ethanol could be used as a fuel, but it had to have chemicals added to it to make it poisonous if drunk. And those chemicals, ironically enough, turned out to be petroleum byproducts. So,
of course.
But anyway, that ruined the fuel economy of alcohol, ethyl alcohol, and of course, just made it completely untenable as a real replacement for gasoline, which was more easily available, more readily available, more cheaply available. There was just no question of competition after that point. So at that point, ethyl alcohol was really only ever used as an additive to gasoline to, you know, improve engine knock and things like that. So prohibition successfully terminated the idea that alcohol fuel would ever be a real alternative to gasoline.
Man, it's just an amazing story. And, you know, whenever I run into conspiracy skeptics, so whether we're talking about 9/11 or anything else, it's always the same answers. They just say, you know, there'd be too many people involved. The secret is too big to keep. But here you have a great example where everybody knew alcohol could be used as a fuel, but yet we don't know that today. Like, they controlled information on this so well that for decades, people just forgot about it. And, you know, when you say secrets can't be kept, I mean, here's one that was kept. There's so many people today who see ethanol as a fuel as part of this whole go green movement, and they think it's something new. They think it's a new development that they're just learning to do. And if only the technology was there, they'd convert us over to a cleaner, more sustainable fuel. I mean, this right here is exhibit A, that a huge secret can be kept, that public knowledge can be put back in the bottle. And, you know, they really have the country by the balls.
I wish it weren't so, but unfortunately it is in a lot of different ways. And I don't want to make it into more than it is. I mean, I think gasoline is and has been cheaper than ethyl alcohol. I mean, it's not a question of which one would have been cheaper in the long run, but I think the undermining of ethyl alcohol as even a potential alternative to gasoline, as you say, petroleum has been at the basis of so many geopolitical involvements and entanglements. And of course, I think it's about so much more what's happening in Iraq or Syria or Libya or places like that. But it has always been the way to sell it to the American public. It's like, well, you know, we need our oil supply. We've got to be involved over there. We have to be bombing brown people on the other side of the planet. That's always been kind of the nudge and the wink to, you know, the old boys network. You know, we got to go in there and take the oil. Can you imagine a world in which that wouldn't even be possible as an excuse for the types of entanglements that the U.S. has engaged itself in? And that really is the sort of alternative that was quashed so effectively back in the early part of the 20th century.
Exactly. Yeah, it is a huge tangled web and a butterfly effect, and all the dominoes seem to fall. But yeah, obviously the imperialism overseas is about more than the oil, but that excuse is so crucial to how they get it done. And when you really hear about the history of this stuff, it makes all these small incremental changes in ethanol or electric cars is another one. It makes them seem like such bullshit theatrics. You know, history shows the technology is a lot more doable than they pretend it is. And I guess that should be one of the big takeaways, right?
Again, you really do have to engage with some of these documents and look at some of the history, because as you say, it's been so completely and effectively suppressed that most people don't have any inkling of this going on. I mean, it's just in the history textbooks, at least in the popular understanding, it's a pretty straightforward path from striking oil in Pennsylvania in the 1850s to the birth of the automobile industry. And it's one to the other. And of course, how are we going to structure our society is going to be around the automobile. That is a series of decisions and steps and plans that were made over a period of time that didn't just arise spontaneously out of the ether, you know. And that's kind of the version of history that we are given is always coincidence theory history. Well, this happened and then this happened and it just all kind of just happened. No one was actually trying to make these events happen. And it's kind of an infantile, almost a bizarre, deranged way of looking at history. I don't know why we would think that these types of massive, major turning points in history would just be happenstance and, oh, you know, shucks, golly gee whiz, you know, who would have thought it would have turned out that way, as opposed to the idea that people who have power and money and interest would conspire to keep that power and money and interest and further it to their, you know, subsequent generations. But for some reason, that's become the unspeakable truth.
Mm-hmm. And like you had mentioned, kind of on socialism or the idea that, you know, the government can provide big projects that people otherwise might not be able to achieve, like a highway system or an electrical grid that's nationwide. And you had mentioned that every time, you know, there's a central authority, it always seems to be abusive and negative. What about the idea of the free market? Because is it possible to really have a free market and do this whole let the free market be our guide thing and not also end up with an inevitable winner who kind of acts in the same way as these industrialists did?
Yeah, I mean, it's the fundamental question that so many people come back to. And I think part of this is that so many of these words and phrases become so completely tarnished by all of the associations and baggage that people bring to them that they become useless in some ways to actually indicate what's happening. So, for example, I mean, the word socialism, the word communism, the word free market has so many associations for people that people often don't even really understand what it is that they're talking about, or maybe they do, but what they're talking about isn't really reflected in what that word implies. So,
guilty.
For example, when it comes back to something like free market, what I would mean when I talk about free market would be voluntary interactions between adult human beings capable of engaging in those types of voluntary interactions. That's what a free market is. No third party can come in and arbitrarily rule that you can't do this or you can do this in terms of voluntary interactions between consenting adults, mm-hmm. Which sounds like a pretty basic ethical principle that is pretty much the golden ethical principle that we're all taught when we're, you know, 3, 4, 5 years old. Don't hit other people. Don't steal their stuff. But, if you want to play with that person, go play with that person, that kind of thing. But for some reason, of course, this all becomes part of this grand socio-political dynamic that, you know, it's socialism versus these free market capitalists and what have you. So ultimately, the answer is, let's put it this way. It comes down to human nature. Human nature is such that there will always be scamsters and con artists and people trying to pull one over on other people. That is absolutely baked into the cake. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I guess you could try to argue otherwise, but I'll believe it when I see it. The point is not, from my perspective, is not to create then an institution run by people who, as I say, would still be prone to the same tenets of human nature to try to scam and con and scheme against other people, mm-hmm. and give them the power to decide what happens in the rest of society, because that base of power will always be corrupted by those insiders, those people who want to use that for their scams. The point is not to create those pockets of power in society. And really, when you think about it, all government is a collective mass delusion that the people who are creating these rules and regulations and laws and running this system have the legitimate authority to do so. How did they gain that authority? By what measure? And how did they get that? Is it because X number of people, 50% plus one or whatever the magic number is, voted in some election to give them that power? Can you vote to give someone a power that you don't have personally? How does taxation work exactly? So there's people who wear funny badges and hats that come to your door if you don't pay the tribute to your supposed masters that you probably didn't even vote for. I mean, what exactly is the basis for this? And the more you interrogate it from those fundamental ethical principles, the less sense it makes. And if the question is simply a utilitarian question, well, I don't care what's morally right. I just care if it works better for, you know, civilization. I still think that the answer would be better, that freedom would be the ultimate answer to these questions because of those that central problem that I talked about, which is that when you have these Standard Oils and GMs and these companies with these people that are headed by these people who are, let's apply the word, I think it fits the bill, evil. I mean, plotting to do things that are absolutely detrimental to the vast majority of humanity and solely for their personal benefit. When you have people doing that, I think, again, giving them access to these centers of power like the U.S. government or, you know, any national government you can think of is the problem. That's how these companies become the monopolies that they are. And we see this over and over and over and over throughout history, that large companies lobby governments to make rules and regulations that eliminate their competition and ensure their monopoly positions. And it was right. The exact same with Standard Oil and so many other things. And then on the back of that, they often set up schemes where the national government, the federal government, the state or local governments will foot the bill for the things that these companies are doing. And we've seen that again with the Green Revolution that the oligarchs were behind in the 1960s, 70s, and the Gene Revolution that's taking place right now, trying to spread GMO around the world. Again, usually at the expense of U.S. taxpayers, for example, through USAID and other programs.
Wow, man. I mean, that was well said. Those are definitely great points. And it does get confusing when you get down to those fundamentals and philosophy of what system is better. And I definitely have more work to do there for sure before I really start spouting off my ignorance about it. But to get back to this saga, the story here gets much worse, you know, once they really secured a ton of wealth, because they weren't comfortable dominating just this one industry and getting fat on an island somewhere. It seems like the next big campaign, and a result maybe of the Rockefeller Makeover campaign and its success, and the founding of the Rockefeller Foundation and the success of their media manipulation, this stuff led them right into going hard after education, right?
Yes, education was really the trial run for what became the Rockefeller blueprint for what they were doing, which was to use philanthropy to further the business interests and consolidate the power, the political and business power of Standard Oil and its associates. Education was really the test run for this, and it started in really the 1890s with the founding of the University of Chicago. Basically, John D. Rockefeller gave a very generous grant to start the University of Chicago, and as of course, I mean, he was footing the bill primarily for this. So he insisted to have some of his people on the board to help select, you know, who would be the professors, who would be the dean, who would control, you know, what happens at this university. I mean, it's only fair, right? And that, of course, was welcomed by open arms by so many people. I mean, hey, he's creating this educational institution. It's going to be a place of higher learning. It's, you know, what a wonderful thing for someone who's, you know, made all this money to do with his money. How could you impugn that? And really is the sort of the thin edge of the wedge of what became a standard practice, which again was to use philanthropy as a cover for things that would ultimately further their interests. And there's a lot to say about the various specific things that they did at these different institutions. And you can look at the University of Chicago and the people. For example, there was one professor that I came across in the when I was doing the research for this that didn't make it into the final cut of the documentary. I don't have the name off the top of my head, but he was talking about how trying to talk basically about the Rockefeller interests, and he ended up getting fired from his position at the university for daring to do so. And I believe that was directly at the request of John D. Rockefeller. So again, control people's education, control their mindset, control the information they have access to, and you control the people. Yeah. And this was something that was quite specifically understood and talked about amongst the people in Rockefeller's set that were focused on this. And specifically, he had Frederick Taylor Gates, this Baptist minister that Rockefeller knew, that he basically put in charge of his philanthropic endeavors generally, and specifically his educational philanthropic endeavors, who talked about trying to mold society in their image, and their image had nothing to do with trying to make better people, making, you know, more learned people. The image, of course, was for Rockefeller and Carnegie and the others that were involved, the 19th century robber barons who were involved in this process, was to mold people into pliable workers for factories, basically. I mean, that was the primary industrial interest of the industrialists. So why else would they be funding education? It only makes sense. And we have this from various documents that they themselves penned, like the Country School of Tomorrow that I talked about in the documentary, where they openly talked about trying to mold people not into lawyers or doctors or preachers or politicians or statesmen, but certainly not into artists or painters or musicians or anything of that sort, not trying to make men of learning or science out of them, but to make responsive and grateful folk out of these people. And so education definitely was the first place where this money was put, and I think probably the least controversial. Again, who could possibly try to find something wrong with the idea that Rockefeller was starting a general education board endowed with $180 million. And this is $180 million in turn of the century dollars. I mean, that's an unimaginably large amount of money. And he was throwing that hand over fist at all of these different institutions. And it wasn't long before that directly parlayed into the next part of the takeover, which was Big Pharma. Because what do you do with this educational power? Well, one of them is you take over the history courses and you start to shape the history curriculum that is then taught to not only in the universities, but then ultimately filters down to the grade school level, so that American history is largely the result of an American Historical Association, which was founded, of course, by money from the Carnegies and the Rockefellers. So again, that process has had a huge effect on the shaping of American history and how people understand it. But the other part of this that directly influenced, had a direct influence, was the shaping of the American college system when it came to medical colleges and what it meant to be a doctor and how that license was awarded. That was part of a concerted attempt to reimagine, reshape the education system for doctors in the United States around the early part of the 20th century. And that was on the basis of something called the Flexner Report that was done by someone who had connections both to Carnegie Endowment. He was funded by the Carnegie Endowment, but eventually went on to become a Rockefeller Foundation associate. This Simon Flexner came out with this report basically saying, oh, look, the medical college system is in tatters. I mean, it differs from state to state what a doctor is, and there's all these quacks getting awarded these degrees. We have to do something about this. And of course, the answer that the Carnegies and Rockefellers come up with, okay, we'll give all this money, tons and tons and tons of money, to making and establishing and really, you know, cleaning out these colleges and making some good medical colleges so that people can have proper, you know, medical training. And with that came the institutionalization of what we now think of as modern medicine, which wasn't what people in the early part, late part of the 19th, early part of the 20th century would have recognized as medicine. At that time, there was a lot more emphasis on homeopathic and naturopathic ideas and remedies that were essentially taken completely out of the picture by this establishment of the American Medical Association, also with Carnegie involvement, and with the Flexner Report establishing really the guidelines for licensing of doctors throughout the United States. And how does this all ultimately tie into Rockefeller business interests? It all goes back to, really, the whole Rockefeller clan, starting with literal snake oil salesman William Rockefeller. Well, that's ultimately what a large part of the sort of oligarch-connected business interests became involved in. They became involved in processing petrochemicals in various ways, for, you know, fertilizers and things like that, but also, of course, for chemical products derived, big pharma, pharmaceutical products derived from petrochemicals. And so you have some of the largest chemical companies in the world and the largest pharmaceutical companies in the world having a large degree of overlap on their boards between large oil companies and the sort of Standard Oil remnants and the big pharma companies. And that, again, all goes back to this idea of trying to take over the education of doctors, and that had a powerful effect on shaping the course of the medical industry.
Yeah, man. Boom. What a great summary. You really covered like four or five of my questions on that subject right there. And it is such an unbelievable saga. And that one component is so key to capturing education and schooling, because now you control the system that determines experts, and you really can control the narrative and flow of any industry at that point. The world is your oyster, and they were just so good at putting a positive face on a negative campaign. It's really staggering how they accomplished all that. And you mentioned how this kind of twisted the teaching of American history, and you know, that is a great example of how this template was rolled out in many different fields, including medicine, like you mentioned. But I'm curious if that move to kind of change and tweak American history, do you see that covering up or changing more than just the PR campaign for the industrialists, maybe changing the way we look at the Industrial Revolution? Do you feel like it did more than that on the history side of things?
Well, there are very specific things that you can look at as to how that helps to shape our understanding of who we are and where we come from. I mean, history, of course, is just one of those fundamental core subjects that really does shape your understanding of where you are coming from, what it means to be an American or whatever, can be so shaped by the collective story that people tell themselves about the past. I mean, that's essentially what history is. Mm-hmm. And by selecting which events, which people, which things to focus on, you really can shape the mindset of an entire nation. One specific example that you can look at with something like that is the Ludlow Massacre. So back in 1914, you had this tent colony of striking coal miners at the Colorado Fuel and Iron Company in the Colorado were striking as a result of just poor working conditions.
Right.
They were part of the United Mine Workers of America. And the of course, the Rockefellers owned the Colorado Fuel and Iron Company. And then you had the Rocky Mountain Fuel Company and the Victor American Fuel Company. And so on April 20th, 1914, there was this battle. I mean, the skirmish broke out between the National Guard and the striking miners. And you ended up with dozens of people dead, and including children and wives of these miners. I mean, it was a horrific event, and it was given attention at that time, and it did become a PR disaster for the Rockefellers. And that's when they really stepped up their PR campaign and their control. And that's really when John D. Rockefeller definitely by that point had left the limelight, and it was John D. Rockefeller Jr. who started to step in. And Jr. only ever was really associated with the philanthropy side of things. So that's when they really tried to flip that switch, and it's like, oh, the Rockefellers aren't in business anymore. We're just philanthropists. And so that's when that really started to happen in earnest. But as I say, at the time, it received a lot of press and definitely gave a black eye to the Rockefellers. But it was really removed from the teaching of history over time, to the point where you had Howard Zinn, The People's History of the United States or whatever, really resuscitated the understanding of events like that in a way that hadn't been heard for generations. So that, again, the idea that there was this mass unrest and there was brutal suppression of these workers at various times in history is not something most people would associate with the history of the United States. I mean, maybe people have some sort of vague understanding of it, but specific events and things like that that really did catalyze national attention and national interest at that time, completely gone. Another great example, actually, of that, probably even a better example, would be the founding of the Federal Reserve.
Right.
Back again, 1913, 1914, extremely, extremely popularly followed and understood story at that time from the late 19th century on. There was huge interest in the question of banking and the banks on Wall Street and how much control they had over the American economy. Extremely popular issue, and a lot of people very interested in it. It affected, everyone understood how the banks and the bankers affected the rest of the economy. The farmers knew, for example, I mean, every year they had to get loans in order to produce their crop and then sell their crop and pay back their loans. I mean, it was the entire economy was so very much focused on these small number of New York-based Wall Street financial firms that really did dictate what happened in the economy generally. And so that in 1907, there was a big panic on Wall Street. You had all these people just all over the place were apoplectic. They were outraged at these at these banks, at these financial firms that they knew were controlling the economy, that had the economy by the cojones. And J.P. Morgan magnanimously stepped in and made sure to underwrite the economy. And he famously locked a bunch of bankers in a room overnight and wouldn't let them leave until they agreed to, you know, underwrite whatever was happening on Wall Street to stop the panic. And, you know, J.P. Morgan saves the day. And then a few years later, I mean, as a result of this, you have people clamoring for some sort of solution. So what's the solution that that people start to focus on? It's the idea of a central bank. We need a central bank in the United States to control these banks. So who gets in front of that movement and makes it their own? The bankers, of course. They want, again, as I say, every time you give this monopoly violence institution the power to create these types of regulatory agencies, it will always be front run by the people who have an interest in it, exactly as it was at that time. But they knew at that time it was such a popular issue, so many people were focused on it, they had to stop the public from finding out what they were up to and trying to get ahead of this and trying to create their own central bank. So they met a number of top bankers, met in complete secrecy in 1910 on Jekyll Island. People might know this story. If they don't, I suggest they check out one of my previous documentaries, Century of Enslavement, that talks about this story. Literally a conspiracy amongst the top bankers and financial oligarchs of the country at that time, including Nelson Aldrich, who just happened to be the father-in-law of John D. Rockefeller Jr. No surprise there. And they met in secret to create what became the seed for the Federal Reserve. It was ultimately forwarded by some different people, but it was essentially the Federal Reserve Act. And one of the conspirators themselves, Frank Vanderlip, actually wrote 25 years after the fact in 1935 in the Saturday Evening Post, wrote about the whole thing. And yes, we were all conspirators and, you know, we had to act secretly because the public would be outraged if they knew we were behind this. Ultimately, of course, they got what they wanted. They got the Federal Reserve, which was really just a cartelization of the banking industry in the hands of the bankers. So they got exactly what they wanted, complete control over the American financial system. And after that point, it had been such a central, such a popular issue, such a part of the popular imagination, so many people focused on it. After that point, the teaching of that part of history and the importance of the central bank and what it does and how the economy is controlled by the banks completely left the popular imagination because it completely left the education system. I don't know. Again, I'm Canadian. I'm not American, so I don't know what kind of things you were taught in U.S. public schools about the central bank and the banking system in the United States. But I know in Canada, we were taught pretty much nothing whatsoever about the monetary system or how it works or monetary history or the fact that there were these huge popular movements in, you know, the populists, political movements and parties in the late 19th century, you know, decrying the bankers and all of this. That completely has left the history textbooks, unless you really study the history of the specifically that time. You know, maybe if you're specifically focused on that in university or something, you might get some of that history, but you don't get it in the average sort of public schooling. And that creates, again, this giant gap in our understanding of what it is. How did this system come into place? How does it affect us? Basic things that are so important to our understanding of the world that, again, can be effaced because, hey, you know, if you control history, you control people's understanding of who they are and where they come from.
Right. Again, well said. And the Federal Reserve is definitely a great example of controlling education. Yeah, we also are taught almost nothing about it. It's just kind of, that's the way it is. That's the way it's always going to be. There's no alternative. Don't even think about it. This is just the system. And damn, James, you do such amazing work. You really are an inspiration. I don't know how you retain so much information and put out such consistent content. You are really a beast, and this is going to be an excellent, excellent show. I really appreciate what you do. Before we go, would you like to remind the people where they can find the documentary we discussed today and all the great stuff you're working on?
If you type "How Big Oil Conquered the World" into any search engine, but preferably not Google, you will find it very quickly. It's also, of course, available on my YouTube channel, youtube.com/Corbett Report, and it is available from my website, CorbettReport.com. That's the best place to go because you can get the transcript is up there. It's in MP3 form. It's in MP4 form, so you can download it either way. I do encourage people to download any and all of my work, repost it, mirror it, remix it, spread it out, burn it to a DVD and hand it to your neighbor, whatever you have to do to get this information out to other people. That's what I do, and that's why I do it. So CorbettReport.com, CORBETT report.com is the one-stop shop for everything I do.
Boom. Very cool, man. Well, thanks again for being here. Keep up the great work out there.
Well, thank you so much for having me on. I do appreciate it.
You got it, man. Take care.